one part of the wall is wallpapered. That's the part they asked the imam, just please sit there so we can take a nice picture of you on the camera. I'm sure that's the only reason why they put him on that particular position. All these guys, and as you say, this big intellectual is sitting there, and he says, I asked the imam about, you know, the running of the affairs of state, the economy, and all that sort of thing. And the imam comes back and says, read Imam Ali. Read Najal Balagha. And he said, I came back with three khutbas of Imam Ali. And only Ali was swimming around in my head and nothing else.
Exactly.
So there we go.
Exactly. You have the famous instructions to Malik Ashraf. We've mentioned this many times in different programs.
Sure.
And this is the point.
Yeah.
The point is that Islam, what is the central message of Islam? Is rely on God.
God. Exactly.
Trust in God. Okay, now they have that on the dollar, in God we trust.
Yes, yes.
But they don't.
They don't.
Okay.
No, in trust is the opposite.
Right.
It's okay. Satan.
They're pharaohs.
Yes. They can't say that, we trust Satan.
Right.
They can't say that. It doesn't sound good on the back
actually,
of a green
Satan
bag.
Will always come with through the door
but
of
it
God.
It doesn't look right, you know. I trust Iblis on the back of the greenback. I can't see that happening. You know,
right.
God, yeah. I mean, God's good.
Right. No. Who's going to deny that?
Who's going to deny that? You see, this is the problem. But you're right. You're right.
It has to do with really doing it, not just mouthing the words.
Yeah,
and then, you know, trying to, you know, outmaneuver the stock market in order to, you know, make a living.
Exactly.
Because you have to trust God, even in difficult times.
Of
I mean, the point is in difficult times.
In difficult times, that's the point. In
when
hardship.
When you've overthrown, you know, the peacock throne and
yes, exactly, and
the whole world is going against
you.
And
yes.
They're like, hey, we're going to bomb you, we're going to do this, we're going to do that. You're like, hey, you know,
in God we trust.
No, and he says, America can't do a damn thing.
Yeah, can't do a damn thing, exactly.
So this is the lesson from Imam. As the other things we discussed about this great man, every aspect of what we saw in him, and we saw him.
Sure.
This is not something that
we saw him.
You know, alhamdulillah, this was one of the great blessings in our life. Allah allowed us to see him. It was all lessons. And they've stayed with us, and inshallah they will stay with us for the rest of our lives, and we have to pass them on.
Sure.
We don't have an excuse on the Day of Judgment.
Exactly. Thank you. On that note, Dr. Mahdi Tarabi, I thank you very much for that enlightening discussion. I hope our listeners benefited from it. Of course, the Imam is a lesson for all times until the Day of Judgment, and we must take stock of his wisdom. But I thank our listeners, and just have to say, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. May the peace and mercy and blessings of Allah be upon you all. Thank you for listening, and goodbye.
Welcome to the lighter side of the news. It's good to have you with us. Well, this looks good. Tourism in Oman took a nosedive during the COVID-19 pandemic, sadly, much like many places in the world. But one village managed to turn its fortunes around by transforming some ancient homes into hotels and touristic attractions. Nestled in the high mountains of Oman, the village of Misfat al-Ibrahim offers some of the most beautiful and serene natural areas for trail running and rock climbing. Now, the village has repurposed ancient mud brick homes into beauty hotels. The beige-coloured homes with walls of handmade mud brick are elegant and simple. And the interior spaces are furnished with traditional wood and textiles.
Misfat al-Ibrahim attracts many tourists, so people and project owners in the village have planned on expanding touristic projects. You'll find heritage hotels, popular cafes and restaurants. We, as a company, decided to provide various adventure-related activities too.
The centuries-old homes were renovated for safety and comfort to combine old Omani life with modern amenities. The village is near what is called Oman's Grand Canyon and has somewhere around 800 residents. Many tourists have visited the area because of the heritage hotels and environmental components in the ancient village. These inns have attracted many tourists to the area despite the COVID-19 pandemic. Almost everyone has seen snowmen, but how many people have encountered a snow snake in their lifetime? A family in the US has awed their neighborhood with a fascinating ice sculpture of a serpent. The household in Colorado spent 10 hours making the impressive artwork in their front yard. They first created the shape of the animal and then sprayed paint on it to bring it to life. The sculpture measures 23 meters in length. It has attracted many neighbors and passers-by who occasionally take pictures with it. This is not the first time the family made headlines with their ice work. In 2019, they caught people's eyes with an ice sculpture of a tiger. A giant ice disc with an even greater message here. People in Finland have carved a humongous carousel in Lake Lahjärvi to raise awareness about global warming. An inventor and a team of helpers spent days in sub-zero temperatures to create what they say is the world's largest ice carousel. The rotating machine is over 300 meters wide and is spun by motorboats. The makers also carved another smaller disc in the ice next to it. The two carousels were commissioned by local authorities who want to bring attention to climate change and shortening winters in Finland. An iceberg the size of Greater London breaks off in Antarctica years after the first cracks appeared. The iceberg detached from the Brunt Ice Shelf near a British research station and is expected to either move away or run aground not far from the ice shelf. Scientists were expecting the calving of the iceberg to happen after monitoring the area with GPS instruments and satellite imagery on a daily basis. They discovered the first cracks almost 10 years ago, but they are skeptical about the role of climate change in this case.
A unique remnant of bygone days. Archaeologists have found a rare ancient Roman ceremonial carriage outside Pompeii. The carriage was unearthed near the stables of a village just outside the very city. It has four wheels and is made of iron, bronze, and tin. The vehicle is the first of its kind discovered in the area. Italy's culture minister has called it a unique find without any precedent in the country. Pompeii was buried under ash and a volcanic eruption in 79 AD. So far, about two-thirds of the ancient city has been uncovered, I should say. The lights, merriment, and traditional food. That's what China's Lantern Festival has brought to millions of people across the country.
Loneliness can hit anyone at any time, but it becomes severe during the pandemic-like scenario the world is going through. But some Japanese are enjoying the companionship of robots to overcome loneliness as they are unable to meet their loved ones during the coronavirus. The cute singing snowman is called Charlie. He is one among a large number of new generation clever robots being produced in Japan. Manufacturers are making a wide variety of affordable androids as well as robotic pets, and they say their sales are booming. They also say their products have found favor with customers of all ages, not just kids. Studies have shown that therapeutic pets can bring comfort to dementia patients.
Spring is coming, and blossoming flowers are once again creating stunning sceneries across China. Clouds of cherry blossoms have created breathtaking views in Wuhan, a city known for being the birthplace of COVID-19. Inside the city, the main university is one of the best places to enjoy those blossoms, being well known for that among the Chinese. Students are thrilled to enjoy the floral scenery after missing it last year.
As the pandemic has been well brought under control in China so far this year, residents in Wuhan City, as well as students, workers, and teachers of the university all come for the flowers and the warm spring.
In other cities, it is the plum flower that attracts a large number of visitors. They say the white-colored blossoms on mountains seem as if it had been snowing. Many of the tourists choose to stay in resorts that offer picturesque views of flowers. Many say they wait for a year so that they can draw a picture of the blossoms.
Police across the globe are using new methods to prevent crime and improve their performance. Now, Pakistani police have come up with an idea to put officers on rollerblades to catch criminals in the commercial hub Karachi. The new armed rollerblading unit is going through rigorous training for over a month with the aim of curbing theft and harassment on the streets. During the training, they were seen carefully balancing on skates while leaping over staircases or lifting their guns. The unit, made up of 10 men and 10 women, would be sent to public places. The chief of the unit says rollerblades make chasing thieves on motorcycles through the city of 20 million much easier.
We felt we needed to come up with some innovative approach to control street crime in Karachi. We analyzed and saw that there are certain spots where crime incidents, say for example mobile snatching, are more frequent. We also saw that criminals use motorcycles that help them run away easily. At times, it is difficult for police teams to chase them from our vehicles.
The unit chief also says that officers would only carry handguns, while in some locations, such as shopping malls, they will not be armed at all. Officers say they can now reach narrow alleys very quickly, where it's usually difficult to go. The rollerblading police are expected to be deployed officially next month.
The coronavirus and related restrictions have forced many businesses to either close or struggle. But some people have found ways to save their jobs and help others to survive the crisis. A top German chef is the one. Peter Frusamer now prepares dishes at a hospital canteen outside Berlin. Frusamer says before accepting the job, he was the head chef at his wife's restaurant. But it was closed due to the pandemic, and he chose to be a hospital cook rather than a jobless man. This German chef says he is happy to find some distraction while working in a hospital kitchen, besides making a contribution to patients' recovery.
I find it frustrating to be here and see the empty tables and the empty restaurant. When I'm at the hospital, I don't notice any of this. For me, the coronavirus crisis doesn't exist at the hospital. Sure, corona is always a topic, but there, I'm at work and I'm busy. But when I come here, I notice what a cut is going through society. That's why I'm happy to have my hospital and to find some distraction. Here in the restaurant, I could actually sit down and start crying.
The hospital staff also seem happy with Frusamer's presence. They say since the arrival of a new chef, they come to eat in the canteen regularly and discover new dishes not eaten before. Frusamer believes the reason health workers and patients love his dishes is that he gives his heart and soul to the food.
Niagara Falls on the US-Canada borders is known for its spectacular timeless beauty, attracting tourists, especially during the summer. But this year's frigid temperature has created another spectacular scene at this natural wonder. Visitors to the New York side of the falls were treated with a remarkable view as a stream falling down the Niagara River is now crusted with ice. A rainbow adds more beauty, leading to the most amazing view of the falls. Every day, dozens of people help each other walk across icy stream to take a closer look at the beauty created by the extreme cold weather. More snowfall, low temperature have been predicted for the coming days, meaning people will have more time to enjoy the place.
For some people, it may take years to build a morning running habit. However, this very special runner seems very impatient in sticking to its daily running routine. The 2-meter-tall ostrich escaped its dwelling to run alongside vehicles on the streets of Beihai, South China. It even tried to keep up with a car's speed by jogging at a very fast pace. The bird's owner says it opened the gates of the farm it stayed in and escaped. He guided the fugitive bird back to the farm by covering his face with a red cloth. The video of the athlete ostrich went viral after its running was caught on traffic cameras. That's a wrap up. Thank you so much for being with us, and bye-bye.
Oh. Punjabi English Radio, a window to peace of mind and spirituality. You can tune in to RIB English Radio 24 hours a day. We are with you. Are you with us? Are you with us? Are you with us? This is our voice from the heart of the Islamic Republic of Iran, RIB English Radio.
The Limelight.
A June 2020 report by the Institute for Policy Research at Northwestern University, which relied on data provided by the U.S. Census Bureau's Household Pulse Survey, states in the United States, food insecurity has doubled overall and tripled among households with children because of the coronavirus pandemic. We're prepared for you an article written by Robin Scher. The piece is titled, The Real Deadly Global Pandemic, Acute Food Shortages. The article has been taken from the Asia Times Daily. Please stay with us for more of Robin Scher's article. Beyond the questions surrounding the availability, effectiveness, and safety of a vaccine, the COVID-19 pandemic has led us to question whether our food is coming from and whether we will have enough of it. According to a United Nations World Food Programme WFP report, COVID-19 might have left up to 265 million people worldwide with acute food shortages in 2020. Another United Nations report states, the combined effect of the pandemic and the emerging global recession could, without large-scale coordinated action, disrupt the functioning of food systems, which would result in consequences for health and nutrition of a severity and scale unseen for more than half a century. A June 2020 report by the Institute for Policy Research at Northwestern University, which relied on data provided by the U.S. Census Bureau's Household Pulse Survey, state in the United States, food insecurity has doubled overall and tripled among households with children because of the coronavirus pandemic. In a recent interview with CBS News, the Institute for Policy Research Director, Diane Whitmore-Schazenbach, warned that these statistics would likely continue to hold, with the numbers indicating particularly dramatic rises in food insecurity among Black and Hispanic families. Globally, the effects of COVID-19 on food security are equally, if not more, severe. According to a CBS News report, World Food Programme Director David Beasley told the United Nations Security Council in April of 2020 that the world is on the brink of a hunger pandemic. David Beasley added, in a worst-case scenario, we could be looking at famine in about three dozen countries, and in fact, in 10 of these countries we already have more than 1 million people per country who are on the verge of starvation. Mark Locock, the Undersecretary General of Emergency Relief Coordinator at the United Nations Office for Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs, and Axel van Trotsenburg, Managing Director of Operations at the World Bank, wrote, the number of chronically hungry people increased by an estimated 130 million last year to more than 800 million, about eight times the total number of COVID-19 cases to date. They said countries affected by conflict and climate change are particularly vulnerable to food insecurity. Empty stomachs can stunt whole generations. The U.S. Department of Agriculture warns that climate change is likely to diminish continued progress on global food security through production disruptions that lead to local availability limitations and price increases, interrupted transport conduits, and diminish food safety. The same might be said about the coronavirus pandemic, which has made it abundantly clear. Climate resilience, food security, and global health are closely intertwined. In terms of food security, another major concern is the pandemic-related school closures that have occurred across the globe, with UNICEF reporting that more than 1.6 billion children worldwide and young people have been affected by school closures. Schools provide a food lifeline for many children. For many, that is where they get their only nutritious meal of the day. In January, the UNICEF Office for Research, Innocenti, and World Food Programme released a new report that found that more than 39 billion in-school meals have been missed worldwide since the coronavirus pandemic began, with 370 million children worldwide having missed 40% of in-school meals. In early 2020, when COVID-19 was still a looming specter rather than the potentially deadly virus we are more familiar with today, the threat of food insecurity was a practical problem. Scenes of shoppers descending on aisles to stock up on supplies were a common sight. As CNN reported in March of 2020, supermarkets around the world rationed food and other products such as toilet paper and cleaning supplies in an effort to curb stockpiling. As the coronavirus pandemic continues to upend lives across the world, it has impacted the entire food supply chain. With the factory and supermarket workers being highly susceptible to COVID-19, there has been a concomitant decline in food production and a rise in prices. As Scott Faber, Senior Vice President of Government Affairs at the Environmental Working Group, EWG, reported, farmers in the United States were already facing labor shortages prior to the coronavirus pandemic, and with tightened immigration, as well as the heightened risk and poor compensation associated with these jobs, food processors and farm labor contractors have struggled to find other workers willing to risk their lives to work in meat plants, packing sheds, or produce fields. The pandemic has exposed the weakness of the industrialized global food system, which depends on long, complex transportation chains and cross-border travel. April Short, a fellow at the Independent Media Institute, recently wrote in Salon.com, "The monstrous and unsustainable food industry, known as Big Ag, relies on the horrendous treatment of laborers, a wasteful allocation of resources, worldwide environmental devastation, and in a pinch, can quickly devolve into near collapse of the entire system, as evidenced by the delays, shortages, and pressure during the COVID-19 pandemic and the deepening hunger crisis in America." April Short said, "Among the many necessary systemic changes 2020 has illuminated is the need to majorly restructure the way we cultivate and access food in our communities." It didn't take the pandemic to reveal the inefficiency and injustice of our food system. Globally, a third of all food is wasted, whilst nearly 619 million people were undernourished in 2019, almost 60 million more people than in 2014. But the coronavirus pandemic has underscored the matter. According to OCHA, the number of acutely food insecure people could increase to 270 million worldwide due to the COVID-19 pandemic, representing an 82% increase compared with the number of acutely food insecure people pre-COVID-19 era. And the disruption of transportation has shown that long distances it normally takes for food to get from one place to another can be a serious liability during a crisis. China, which was the first country to be hit by the coronavirus that caused COVID-19, offers insight into the prolonged impact of the pandemic on transportation and food systems. According to an article in The Conversation, the lockdown in Hubei province in China, which is home to 66 million people, led to a shortage in delivery of animal feed, as well as refrigerated containers full of imported vegetables, fruit, and frozen meat in February of 2020. Food insecurity has long been a pressing issue, particularly for developing countries. However, as Mir Ashrafun Nahar, a research associate at the South Asian Network on Economic Modeling, explained in a Financial Express article, the COVID-19 pandemic has made it more acute. In response, Mir Ashrafun Nahar argues for a policy-based approach that includes subsidy-based transportation systems for agriculture to support supply chains, as well as policies aimed at cutting down on agricultural production costs in order to help farmers recover from the effects of the coronavirus pandemic. The Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development, OECD, an intergovernmental economic group with 37 member countries, said that the pandemic has laid bare pre-existing gaps in social protection systems in a report published in June of 2020. The Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development, OECD, report states, while the impacts of COVID-19 are still unfolding, experience so far shows the importance of an open and predictable international trade environment to ensure food can move to where it is needed. The report added, the biggest risk for food security is not with food availability, but with consumers' access to food. Safety nets are essential to avoid an increase in hunger and food insecurity. Another problem is the lack of media coverage about the food insecurity being witnessed around the world, particularly during the COVID-19 era. As The Economist recently pointed out, journalists in 2020 wrote more than 50,000 articles about the cancelled Eurovision Song Contest, but only around 2,000 articles about drought and hunger in Zambia. For meaningful reform to the food system to occur, change is going to happen at every level, from national level, state level, and local government, to big agriculture, big ag, small farmers, and everyday consumers. With a future looking ever more uncertain due to the climate crisis, adapting to new ways of producing and transporting food will be the key to our survival.
Dark Review.
Hello and welcome to Doc Review with me, Camelia Shambayaki. In today's show, we're discussing US Election Day documentary 11-8-16. Produced and created by Jeff Deutschman. And joining me in the studio, we have Anna Smith, who is a film critic and broadcaster. She is also the president of the UK Critics Circle and a regular film critic for various mainstream channels. And beside her, we are also joined by Jonathan Fryer, who is a lecturer, broadcaster, and freelance writer. Now, on the 8th of November 2016, Americans from all walks of life went to the ballot box to vote for their next president. Though little did they know at the time what would be in store for them, after most people believed that the country would be seeing its first female president be elected. This documentary, which features the work of many directors and film crews, follows a cross-section of Americans throughout that fateful day and shows the complex and diverse spectrum of opinions about their reasons for voting for Trump or for Clinton, or in some cases, not voting at all.
Days to election, I can update this.
Did you vote today?
I voted early.
You did?
Friday.
Did it feel great?
Today, I'm going to vote for the first time in almost 30 years.
Morning, gentlemen.
I'm a little nervous about the outcome of the election, future for the coal industry.
You can't stop doing politics. Knock on doors and say, hey, excuse me, did you vote today? Be polite. It's a beautiful day.
The election will be over by 9 o'clock, so call it by 9:30, and everything will be peaceful and wonderful.
What if it goes the other way?
What?
It's going to go the other way. No way. You mark it down.
Thank you.
I could feel eyes watching me as I walked through that crowd, like they hated me, like I was Donald Trump.
They say, you know, your vote may make a difference, but to me, I don't think so.
हम रहते हैं इस कंट्री में, कमा के हम खाना खाते हैं, पीछे अपने फैमिली की टेक केयर करते हैं, तो आई प्रे अमेरिका लिव लॉन्ग एंड प्रॉस्पर.
It looks like maybe we should be planning for the too close to call scenario or the Trump win.
Now, who we had as president, the African Americans were still the lowest man on the totem pole.
There's hope. Never forget that the power of the people is stronger than the people in power.
From sea to shine.
First of all, welcome to the show. Thanks very much for both of you for coming on. Now, this documentary could be seen as quite a historic and invaluable piece of filmmaking, as it gives the world viewers an insight, sort of a window into the psyche of Americans voting that day and what they were thinking. And Anna, if I could start with you as our guest film critic, what was your take on this documentary?
I think you're right that it's an interesting snapshot of Americans, and it also has an emotive subject, a fascinating subject, which all great documentaries need. And what all great documentaries need as well is great characters. And this has lots of really strong characters, people who are voting from different sides, who strongly believe in what they're talking about, and the access to them on a day that is a very important day in their lives means that there's some explosive conversations and some very telling and revealing conversations. So broadly, I liked it.
That's a great opinion. And Jonathan, would you agree with what Anna just said?
Yes, I mean, the technique of the documentary was really interesting. The producers called it a periscope view, with 16 periscopes popping up across all the way from New York over to Hawaii, even interviewing different families and individuals. And of course, it's fascinating because watching it, we know the outcome. But during the film itself, until right at the end, the actual voters are not aware of the outcome. But many of them are really, really engaged, as they either want to Hillary Clinton to win, as what was expected originally, or they're rooting for Trump. And it's fascinating to see how their mood changes, in some cases optimistically, in other ways, for other people, disastrously, as they see exactly what they didn't want to happen and literally are brought to tears.
And the dramatic irony of all, actually, is what makes the film so fascinating and relevant today to watch, actually. And I just want to talk about Jeff Dutchman's previous work. He made a similar film about Obama's election campaign and his supporters. And I bet we can imagine that probably had a different tone than compared to this film. What do you think, Anna?
Absolutely. Yeah, I mean, I think it's a very different, because of course it's fascinating. He goes about these films without knowing the outcome. But obviously people were much more optimistic about Obama winning, and this was a bit of a surprise result in this case. So it's fascinating to think that when he and all the directors involved, he sort of curated this.
And what a feat for filmmaking, actually. I wonder how difficult that must have been to coordinate.
Yeah, he sourced a lot of great filmmakers from all over the world who were very talented. And obviously a lot of them probably had a connection with their subjects, which gave rise to some very, very interesting people and subjects. But yeah, I mean, just watching it in retrospect then makes it particularly interesting, of course, because there is this sense of perhaps impending doom or success, depending on your point of view, that you just know is going to be a real shock to some people that you're watching. So it adds to the tension.
It was a great collaborative project indeed. And Jonathan, just quickly before we move on, if you could just take us back to that time, why was it so shocking for Trump to win? And in hindsight, is it actually that surprising?
He was an extraordinary candidate, and of course has become now a very extraordinary president, because he was absolutely not the normal run-of-the-mill politician, basically. He was anti-politician. And so it was an enormous shock when he was elected. And everyone did expect, most people expected, Hillary Clinton would win. And I'm sure the director was thinking, right, but it didn't happen.
And it was much to everyone's surprise, actually.
It's
So you are in the vast majority of the populace that does not vote.
You're feeling about that?
I feel pretty good. More than we are voting for any particular candidate, we are voting for the system. And it is a system that I just don't abide by.
We don't need new legislation. We don't need a new politician. We don't need the Constitution to change to actually, like, care for our community. You just have to have the will. That's where I put my effort. I put my effort there because I think change comes from the work that we do, not from the ballot box.
My white people have always had the right to vote, right? Like, my lineage has always been, we've been the power, right? So what would you say to somebody who would be like, wait a minute, you're an American.
You mean like my grandmother?
Yeah, like your grandmother.
As much as I really honor the nothing less than heroics that it took in order for African Americans to be able to vote. You know, getting the right to vote was the equivalent of walking into a room, a game of Monopoly was being played by all rich white men. The game was already in motion, property was already bought, hotels already built, and African Americans earned a right to sit at the table. They earned a right to sit at the table, start in jail, didn't collect $200, start off with no money, no property, nothing. That's a game you cannot win. It's about time that we walk in and wipe the whole damn game off the table and start over.
I think one of the most prominent issues this documentary exposes is the clear racial division in the U.S. Thinking back to the scene where we see in Chicago African Americans talking amongst themselves of the conflict they feel in having to choose between Trump or Clinton, and they say that Clinton obviously isn't the great candidate for them either, considering the whole super predator count scandal and the three strikes are out sort of thing, and then Trump isn't so great on minorities either. Anna, could you just tell us, did this documentary, was it effective in exposing this racial divide and how complicated this issue is?
I think you're right, it is an extremely complicated issue, and it's very hard in the space of a documentary like this, especially with so many different people and so many different directors, to really get to the heart of the issue. But at the same time, it did touch on a lot of that, and it was very careful, I think, to have a variety of people from different sides and of different races talking about how they felt about it. And I thought the filmmakers succeeded in getting people to be very frank about racial issues, as we saw just there, and very articulate. So it was thought-provoking for me on that level.
And Jonathan, would you agree? Do you think this documentary
the diversity nation? Rather than the division, the diversity of the American population. People have been there for generations. Some were very new immigrants. It's interesting, it starts with a Sikh taxi driver who is clearly from a Punjabi family who probably very recent immigrants and rather excited by the idea that they will be able to vote. So in that sense, I think it's extremely valuable in showing the different races, ethnicities, religions, etc., that make up the United States. But without a doubt, some people, very clearly in the film, felt disenfranchised, even if they were able to vote. It's interesting, it ended with a very poor couple in Hawaii living in a tent in a park, who basically sort of say, well, you know, okay, it was election, but what sort of difference is it going to make to our lives? Nothing whatsoever.
And I like how it came actually full circle to that point, actually, that some people are very helpless when it comes to politics and it doesn't make a difference to them. So I just want to talk about some statistics now. Data from the election actually shows that the majority of young white Americans, both male and female, under 44 years old, voted for Hillary Clinton, whereas those mostly over 45 overwhelmingly voted for Trump. So Jonathan, why do you think Americans voted the way they did?
Well, there clearly was a very stark generational divide. It's rather interesting, we had a very similar phenomenon here in Britain in 2016 with an EU referendum of which 45 and over majority voted to leave the EU, 44 and younger voted to stay. So there clearly is something happening between the different generations. But what was really also very interesting about the statistics in the US election was that people outside the cities voted for Trump. It was sort of like a rural revolution of people, particularly older people who maybe had seen their hopes dashed for a brighter future and were therefore determined to go out and to make a protest, basically.
Well, we're lucky to have Jonathan here to give us political context to this. I was just quickly wondering, Anna, would you have liked for more political context to these stories?
I think it's also well publicised now that even the most casual observer of the news will know exactly what happened on that day and what the results were. and what the ramifications would go on to be for the people that we see on camera. I found it interesting as someone that doesn't necessarily follow every inch of political news to find out who, you know, the sort of makeup of the voters and the characters of the voters, because, and particularly the Trump voters, because you hear a lot about and see a lot about Trump himself, but to see who actually voted for him and then giving the reasons why, I found fascinating.
And of course, we actually learned that a lot of people who voted for Trump were scared to admit they voted for Trump. So it was only in the aftermath that we really found what was actually happening. I'm glad we've got to see the sort of behind the scenes of the media rooms and them preparing for the election result. And they largely believed Clinton was going to win. Anna, what could we learn from the documentary about the role media or social media played in the election?
What was fascinating was that they felt that they kind of knew, I mean, they prepared for every scenario, but there was that confidence in the polls, which evidently was misplaced. So I think a lot of journalists could probably learn from that scenario from watching it. I certainly found it fascinating watching those journalists there sort of hedging their bets, but basically thinking that Hillary was going to win. In terms of the media, in terms of people from all walks of life making assumptions based on what they see and hear. And also when you see people in this documentary watching the results come on screen, on their own TV screens, you just see how sheltered some of those people are on both sides and how little they understand about other people's opinions and how we become, you know, even in social media, we only really need to follow people with a similar point of view, which isn't, social media is not really explored in this, but I think that's something that is a springboard for thinking about that.
Definitely, and it raises many questions actually. And Jonathan, if I could put that question to you, what role do you think actually the social media played on the election?
Well, it's two different things, the mainstream media and the social media. The mainstream media, it's clear that most of them, with exceptions such as Fox News, were rooting for Hillary Clinton and firmly expected her to win, though obviously they had to make provision for a result of a different kind. Social media was an entirely different matter because there, the Trumpers, if you can call them that, were really in the ascendant. And this is the first presidential election in the United States where social media have a huge impact. And Donald Trump himself has millions of followers, whereas many people may say that a lot of what he tweets about on Twitter is rubbish or untrue, it has a huge effect and he has that great following. And he, of course, despises the mainstream media, talks about fake news because the liberal commentators on the LA Times and other newspapers, of course, are opposed to the sorts of things that he believes in and propagates.
And why is it that so many people could believe this, though, that he could label the news, certain news channels fake news and he was so hostile to the press?
Well, we've come into what's called the post-truth world, where it's no longer, what is true that you necessarily accept, but it's what you believe is truth. In other words, if it fits in with your own prejudices and your own approach, then that's fine. That's the news and that's what you're going to put forward.
And so there's so many interesting questions then that this documentary could raise. Do you think there's any other points and strong themes that this documentary had?
Well, I felt like it could have gone further. It could have shown more Trump supporters, as I said. It could have been more revealing. But in terms of the points it made, for me, characters are such a huge part of it. And to see the dynamic, particularly between the husband and wife in Massachusetts, and she's a little bit more reserved about Trump and he's really gung-ho, and to see the difference between families and couples and generations and how they interpret politics and speak to each other about politics, I thought was really, really interesting.
And that's an interesting point, actually, not to defend Trump supporters, but you realise that they're human beings and not all of them are evil, but they have different motivations and grievances for voting in terms of the whole system and their fight, especially when it comes to finances, I think, in the documentary.
A lot of times I work a long day. I'm out of the house before my kids even get out of bed. And then when I come home, it's 6 o'clock at night, it's dark, you know, it's time to eat dinner and go to bed, basically. So if the economy got better and I was bringing more people and more work into my shop and I could delegate a little bit more, then I'd be able to spend more time with my family. That'd be huge. That would be huge for me. I'm doing okay for myself right now, but it would be even that much better, you know? I don't know. I think if when Hillary gets elected, and I think she's going to get elected because she's going to
cheat.
If she's going to raise the taxes on everybody, and healthcare right now is crushing us anyway, so I'm concerned that we're going to have a tough time making ends meet.
It's not right. And you know Hillary doesn't care about anything but her pockets. take that stupid hat off, man.
I will not take this hat off.
What contribution do you think they made to the documentary?
They brought an entertainment factor, I think, which is really important. There's nothing to say that documentaries about political subjects need to be entirely serious. And it was sort of dark humour, but just seeing the dynamic between them was really involving and entertaining. But it also showed, as I said earlier, that you can, within a couple, see different political views and see different strains and strengths, but also what worrying things that people might be influencing each other and perhaps voting and what they don't personally actually really believe in, they're being swayed.
Jonathan, would you agree with what Anna said?
Yeah, they were a fascinating family, and they raised two issues there in that which are really important. You know, there's tax, because Trump was saying he was going to cut taxes particularly for the higher income earners, which would be attractive to business people. And the other thing was Obamacare. You know, one of the huge things that really figured in the election was the cost of Obamacare. President Obama brought in a system where poor people had medical insurance.
Surely that's a good thing.
Great,
of course, but the
Trumpers, on the other hand, were saying we're paying for all these people to do that. A very interesting point made by a number of people during the film is they were voting against someone rather than for someone. And that's why Hillary lost, even though, of course, she actually got more votes than Trump did in the popular vote. But she was more unpopular than Trump was.
And does that expose flaws then, I suppose, in the American voting system?
Well, to us in Britain, we don't have a flawless system here either, but it does seem really weird that someone can win the popular vote but lose the presidency.
Mm. And indeed, and I just wanted to talk about the parallels actually between the UK and the US and theatrical aspect of the US. I was just wondering, is there a documentary of this sort that would be as fascinating in the UK as it would be to follow an American election? Do you think it would be as interesting?
Well, obviously, Brexit docs are fascinating, aren't they? I mean, that's the closest thing we've had recently. You're right, though, the Americans do have a showy way about them. But goodness, look at reality TV shows in the UK. We've certainly got our fair share of big personalities, so I think good documentaries can always find them.
Yes. Oh, no, that's a good point, actually, indeed, also, that we can compare. And I guess UK politics seems to be a bit more on the serious side, or perhaps not.
Well, it'd be very interesting. The next election, presumably, we will have Jeremy Corbyn leading the Labour Party into an election campaign, and there'll be a big focus on, is this a man who can be Prime Minister? Is this a man who can lead Labour Party to victory? Because the opinion polls at the moment are saying more or less the Conservatives and Labour equal pegging, which is bizarre when the government is doing things which are frankly difficult to support. Why isn't the opposition miles ahead? So there's a ground for a real mystery there. So perhaps some documentary maker could already be plotting the election coverage documentary of Election Day, whenever it's going to be.
Perhaps. And just going back to the documentary, as we near the end of this discussion now, actually, I just wanted to get, Anna, your final thoughts on this documentary, and also would you recommend it?
I don't think it's an earth-shattering documentary, but I think it's very, very interesting. And I think if you want a further insight into what motivated a lot of American people to place their vote a certain way, then it's well worth a watch.
And Jonathan, if I turn to you, your final thoughts on the film?
When it first started, I thought, oh my goodness, we're going to watch this for an hour and 45 minutes. Am I going to really be interested? But you do get interested in the characters and the individual families. In fact, I was disappointed when it finished.
And we'll have to leave it there on that good note to end it on. Thanks very much for coming on. And that's it for this episode of Doc Review. Thank you to both my guests and to you. I've been Camila Shambiati.
This is IRIB English Radio.
IRIB English Radio, with you every single moment.
ایمان را در خودتون تقویت بکنید، ایمانی که هم در اینجا شما را شرافتمند می کند و هم در پیشگاه حق آبرو دارید و با آبرومندی وارد می شید به تخت اعلی.
In the path of the Imam.
In the name of God, salam and welcome to the program. Dear listeners, we are with you with another episode of this series. In continuation of discussing Imam Khomeini's ethical virtues, we are going to touch upon his detachment to the worldly and material issues. Of course, this does not mean the Imam led a life of a hermit in seclusion from the society. Rather, it means that he tried his best to form the strongest bond with God and the spiritual world while living among people and helping them in their problems. One of the unique characteristics of Islam is the approach towards this world. The Islamic view to the world is focused on refraining from the worship of God on the one hand and prohibition of seclusion and hermitage on the other. Islam is quite different from the religions that preach seclusion from society and going to a temple far from the social responsibilities. It emphasizes that the faithful are duty-bound to heed material issues while detaching themselves from its trappings. In other words, Islam warns against going to extremes on both sides. According to the teachings of Islam, God calls on the faithful to enjoy the bounties of this world as they are not obstacles on the way of spiritual perfection if they are used in the correct way. In the first years of Islam, a few Muslims had misunderstood Islam and tried to live like Sufis, away from the worldly affairs. One of them had left his family and stayed in a mosque to spend his time in worship. Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny, strongly castigated his behavior, saying, "Do you know that God has not sent me for hermitage? My religion is the religion of innate nature. I perform prayer, fast, and I associate with my wife. Anyone who follows my religion should accept my practice. Marriage and association between wife and husband is among my practices." The Noble Quran also recommends the faithful to enjoy halal bounties. In Ayah 168 of Surah Baqarah, we read, "O mankind, eat of what is lawful and pure in the earth, and do not follow in Satan's steps. Indeed, he is your manifest enemy." Contrary to seclusion from the world, Islam has called on its followers to enjoy the worldly bounties while keeping aloof their harmful aspect. Islamic texts and the Noble Quran use the word zuhd in this regard. Zuhd means paying attention to this world's affairs in a way that they do not prevent us from moving in the path of perfection and sublimity. Hermits and most of the nuns and monks in the West try to detach themselves from material world in a way that they do not participate in people's affairs and are apart from their problems. But Islam stresses that the path of perfection and proximity to God passes through social responsibilities and communion with people. Imam Khomeini, God's mercy upon him, was among the persons who enjoyed the virtue of zuhd at a very high level. Ayatollah Jafar Sobhani says, when the Imam preached ethics, he would censure seeking the world and worshipping the world. Sometimes after the end of the class, one would dislike the world to the extent that it would look as a broken pottery that nobody pays attention to it. Hujjatul Islam Zainul Abedin Bakui also recounts this. After the demise of late Grand Ayatollah Burujerdi, the seminaries were closed for 40 days. On the first day of the classes, Imam Khomeini advised the students not to grieve on their sustenance. When the students asked him what to do after the demise of the great source of emulation, the Imam answered, "You should have high ambition so that the world is not worth a farthing in your eyes." Dear listeners, although on the one hand Imam Khomeini would prevent the students of seminaries and ulema from attaching to the world, on the other hand, he would seriously warn them not to sacrifice their hereafter for the world of others. Late Ayatollah Bani Fazl said, "In the beginning of the sacred Islamic uprising, when Imam Khomeini had become known as the source of emulation, he told his family members, 'If there is a chairmanship and world, it is not for you. If you are wise, do not spend from your religion for my world. Stay firm and resolute in your religion.'"
September 11, 2001, two hijacked airplanes were flown into the Twin World Trade Center buildings, killing almost 3,000 people. Soon after, then-President George W. Bush announced that time has come for the world to come together and fight a war against all those who seek to export terror. That announcement gave birth to the first war of the 21st century, the so-called War on Terror. 20 years after the invasion of Afghanistan by the U.S.-led forces, the U.S. counterterrorism operations have only expanded. A recent report published by the Cost of War Project at Brown University's Watson Institute and USA Today shows that despite the talk of refocusing on great power competition, counterterrorism policy of Washington has not changed. According to the report, the U.S. military has been in over 85 countries in the past 3 years. U.S. troops have conducted bombing or ground attacks in 10 countries, including Afghanistan, Yemen, Syria, Iraq, Kenya, Libya, Mali, Nigeria, Pakistan, and Somalia over the same period. Washington also owns nearly 800 offshore military bases on all six continents. That's while China, as the biggest competitor of the U.S., has only one official overseas military base in Djibouti. Another report by the Stockholm International Peace Research Institute, SIPRI, revealed that the U.S. spent over $732 billion on national defense in 2019. That was more than the next 10 countries combined. The forever war has lasted for two decades to the tune of $6.4 trillion, resulting in calls on Washington